Blog Talk Radio.
In the desert, speaking hope and freedom to Iran. I'm your host, Randy L. Noble. So very glad that you've taken out some time from your busy schedule to join me on my program this morning. What I want to do is I want to go right away to the top story I want to share with you, because the petition is on my Facebook page, and I really ask you, before you do anything else today, to please come by my Facebook page and see this petition for the mother in the UK who is being held hostage in Iran, and for no apparent reason that she's really done anything, but because she's a dual citizen there. There's a lot of suspicion with the Iranian government. She's been there over a month, and I want to talk to you today about Nazanin Ratcliffe. Some good news: just a few days ago, she was allowed to see her daughter and parents. And she's 37 years old, and she was allowed out of solitary confinement for over 2 hours on Wednesday, this past Wednesday. She was taken from a prison to a hotel in the city of Kerman, which is really about 600 miles from Tehran. And there she was permitted to have lunch with her parents and see her daughter, Gabriella, who's really only 22 months old. Can you imagine a daughter, a 22-month-old young little baby separated from her mom this long? Well, thank God they were able to reunite. Now, Nazanin's husband, Richard, said he was grateful to the Iranian authorities for the visit. And she was able to hold and play with Gabriella for a visit of more than 2 hours. Now, actually, they gave Gabriella a little doll. And this was a good chance for the mother and daughter to bond once again. Now, back in April 3rd, when Nazanin was visiting her parents in Iran, she was trying to leave the country to go back to the UK, and that's when she was apprehended and separated from her daughter. And this is really a horrible situation, as you can imagine, but I want to tell you some good news. Since her husband, Richard, has initiated this petition, over 400,000 signatures have been affixed to this petition. So thank you, each one of you, all of my Facebook friends, for speaking out for this poor Iranian young woman who is separated from her family. Now, actually, Nazanin has worked in the UK since 2007. She works as a program manager for Thomson Reuters Foundation. It's the charitable arm of the news agency. So since about 37 days ago, 400,000 signatures. It's fantastic. Now, the bottom line is we need to keep up the pressure on the Iranian government. They need to see that this is an international agreement and that they will not just idly stand by and watch this lady suffer in prison. And even though she had an opportunity to be reunited with her daughter and see her parents, make no mistake, the Iranian regime is very brutal with those with dual citizenships. They're very suspicious of them. Back in, I don't know how many years ago, there is another British Iranian. Her name is Kamal Forjari. She has been in prison since 2011. It is horrible. That's over 5 years simply because dual citizens that hold Western passports. So once again, if you haven't signed, please come to my Facebook page, Randy L. Noble. You'll see the petition there, and be a voice of hope and freedom for Nazanin. Now, I want to go to this next story, which is just, I cannot tell you the emotions I have with this story. It's Iran's Holocaust mocking cartoon contest. They have this every year, and they come out in the media and say they have nothing to do with the organization that sponsors this Holocaust marking cartoon contest, but it really ends up being a lie because the track record is Iran hates Israel. President Ahmadinejad a few years ago when he was president said that they should be wiped off the face of the map. But just recently, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, he lashed out at this cartoon mocking contest. Iran has long backed armed groups committed to Israel's destruction, and its leaders, like I mentioned, have called for it to be wiped off the map. And, of course, Israel fears that Iran's nuclear program is designed to threaten its very existence. And here's what Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu just recently said about this Holocaust mocking cartoon contest. It denies the Holocaust, it mocks the Holocaust, and it's also preparing another Holocaust, Netanyahu said. He said, I think that every country in the world must stand up and fully condemn this. Can you imagine 6 million Jews, it's documented in every museum all over the world, suffered and died at the hands of Germans in gas ovens, and of course the Iranian regime mocks this with this cartoon contest and goes on record as denying that it actually happened. It's very offensive speech, Netanyahu said. It must be condemned by the authorities and civil society leaders rather than encouraged. We denounce any Holocaust denial and trivialization as inflammatory and abhorrent. It is insulting to the memory of the millions of people who died in the Holocaust. So it's just awful. I can't imagine anyone making fun of the suffering of the Jewish nation. I have a good Facebook friend. Her name is Leora Eisenberg. And she just recently, as a young student, young university student, took some time out and wrote a blog about the Holocaust. And it's about not just so much the denial, it's kind of like the trivializing of the Holocaust. And it's called Spray Painting Auschwitz. And here's what Leora, a Jewish student, said. She says, I don't like talking about the Holocaust. I do not think anyone does. Hardly a pleasant topic. The Holocaust is not a downright taboo. We discuss it academically, and we write books about it. We go to lectures about it and study it in school. It's not like nobody discusses the Holocaust, Leora writes, but nobody jokes about it. Well, nobody should. She writes, a few days ago, I overheard a few students discussing a prank they want to pull next year. You know what would be funny, one asks? What? The other answered breathlessly. If we spray-painted Albiat Makfre on the doors to the school. Now, for those who don't know what Albiat Makfre means, it means work makes you free. And that was the slogan at the entrance to Auschwitz, as well as other concentration camps. The others wooted and cheered, proclaiming that was a great idea. And usually, Leora writes, I stay out of other people's conversations. After all, who wants to argue over lunch? But this time I broke my rule. That's not funny, I said, keeping my voice frighteningly level. You know, if you make a joke out of something, you break the taboo. By making it funny, you desensitize yourself to the topic. The Holocaust is not meant to be funny, and you are not meant to desensitize yourself to it. Oh, come on. Don't get so touchy, Leora. If you want to call me touchy, fine. Likening school, however, to Auschwitz, creating an identical entrance and not expecting me to reject that idiocy, to not be touchy, is ridiculous. Your hatred of school does not equal the murder of 12 million, 6 million of whom were Jews. You're saying the humor inherently devalues things? That's not what we mean. You're totally misunderstanding. It's just a joke. No, that's not what I'm saying, Leora retorted. I'm saying genocide is not a joke, and you seem to think it is. I walked away. Now, I don't think these kids, Leora writes, are anti-Semitic. I just think they're stupid. For them, the Holocaust means little. They probably don't know any Holocaust survivors. Their knowledge of the Holocaust, and really of genocide in general, stems from mandatory book reports about Anne Frank and Primo Levi, if they're really lucky. But would someone have entertained the discussion of spray-painted mock genocide 60 years ago? 50? 20? It's hard to say, but catastrophic memories were still ripe, and the parents of many children were still Holocaust survivors. Now, their grandparents and great-grandparents are Holocaust survivors, and they aren't about to come to school and see the damage. 70 years after the greatest evil mankind yet has known, our children and their friends forget its evils and try to destigmatize them. Some things are just not meant to be funny, are destigmatized. Some things are meant to remain horrible and evil and scary and beyond any words. So why must these words be reduced to an inky arbeit mock fry on the school doors? Leora Eisenberg. Oh, so well written, Leora. And she's dealing with Jewish people, her own brethren. And her whole point is they're not being anti-Semitic. They're being insensitive to a horrible tragedy that has no room for joking about, no room for playing jokes about. There's nothing funny about the Holocaust, and yet this is what Iran does. They mock the greatest evil in the world. They do so without any restraint. And thank you so much, Leora, for pointing out that this is an evil event. There has never anything been funny about it, and there are no jokes. It's very offensive. Thank you, Leora, for pointing that out to us today. I want to talk about some more of the evil that the Iranian regime does to human beings. But before I do that, I want you to hear this song by Brett Nicole. It has a lot of meaning to what I'm going to talk about. We're going to hear this song, and I'll be right back on the cross in the desert.
Keep
That is Britt Nicole, and the song is called Gold, and it's the perfect intro to what I want to talk to you about. We've just spent the last few minutes looking at the evil propaganda that the Iranian regime paints about the Holocaust. We also heard from Leora Eisenberg, her great blog, talking about how even some of her own family and friends are desensitizing this topic. And there's nothing funny or joking about it, and she's spreading this information, she's sharing it with us so that we can join her in condemning this event as evil. And as Patricia so rightly pointed out, and Mary rightly pointed out in the chat room, that if Iran is mocking this Holocaust, then they're admitting that it's really evil. And so their twisted thinking doesn't work very well. Thank you so much, Mary and Patricia, for making that point. They can't deny it, and they can't trivialize it. It's a real evil. I want to talk to you this morning about an incident that took place in Iran a couple of years ago. My good friend Atafi, who lives there in Tehran, who is actually, her stories are in my book, The Cross in the Desert, the book I'm holding right now in my hand. She shared with me an event that just angered her beyond words. I remember at my job at Family Christian, I was on the way to the bank to make a deposit, and she texted me. She said, "Randy, they are insane." And I said, "Well, what are you talking about, Atafi?" And she says, "Do you know what they're doing?" She says, "I'm here in this clothing store." As she's texting me, as she's right there in the clothing store, she says, "They're making the store owner put veils on mannequins." And I stood there and I said, "You are kidding me." And she began to share with me, because it was just close to Nowruz. And for those of you who don't know, Nowruz is the Persian New Year. And most Iranians start that whole celebration out by going and buying new clothes. It's part of the celebration they prepare for by cleaning their house, getting ready. And they go out and buy new clothes. And so Atafi was in the clothing store. And she was shopping for clothes. And she noticed the police was up front talking to the manager. And she kind of bended her ear close to what was going on. And they were saying to the manager, "You're in violation of the Islamic dress code, and you must put veils on these mannequins." And Atafi said, I just doubled up in anger. She said, "It's so insane. Veils on mannequins. Well, wait a minute. Help me out, please. Is there not a distinction between human beings and mannequins?" Well, think about it. What is a mannequin? A mannequin is a lifeless form of plastic representing a human being that is used to display the latest fashions in store windows. Oh, I get it now. Okay. The Iranian regime would prefer that all Iranians be just like mannequins. Mannequins don't speak or talk back or protest or whine or complain. These lifeless plastic forms wear whatever you put on them without a complaint, and they stand in the window all day. Well, this is so sad. It seems that image is everything according to Iranian law. Iranians are supposed to obey without complaint and wear whatever they are told, just like mannequins in the store window. The sad reality, think with me, the sad reality to this image of everything scenario is that it reduces real human beings to lifeless forms without heart and souls. Human beings cannot exist under these conditions, and they lose all self-worth and self-esteem, and that's exactly what false religion does. It robs all people of all meaning and purpose in life, and it reduces them to little more than puppets or mannequins. Well, God didn't create us as lifeless forms or puppets on a string. He created you and me with great value and gave us a heart to discover the beauty of life that surrounds us. He breathed into our souls love, purpose, creativity, so that you and me will shine like the brilliant colors of the rainbow and make a difference in a world of suffering and pain. Think about it. The song we just heard, Britt Nicole, "You are worth more than gold." There is infinite value on every human being because they're created in the image of God. And what the Iranian regime is saying with the whole scenario of putting veils on mannequins, what they're saying is, We want you Iranians to be like these mannequins. You don't whine or complain. You just dress whatever we put on you, and you stand in the window all day. And you see, that's what we want. We want the world to see that you are compliant to the Islamic dress code. It's tragic. It's so tragic. This is what religion reduces people to. Mannequins. And when you think about what a mannequin really is, and when you see pictures of mannequins, you understand that human beings have greater worth than a lifeless form of plastic. But what happens in the Iranian regime is that they reduce the beauty and the worth of human beings to nothing more than plastic, lifeless forms of mannequins. And they also do it with the Jewish people by mocking, desensitizing, and denying the Holocaust and saying that 6 million beautiful souls didn't really die. They're treating them like lifeless forms of plastic and mannequins. If you've ever been to a Holocaust museum, and I have here in Missouri, there is a Holocaust museum, and you walk through the displays, you see the freight cars, the train cars, the cattle cars of people squashed together on the way to the concentration camp. You see the shoes laying in piles, a monument to the dead victims who were gassed. You see the people that are struggling to survive, their skin and bones. And then you say, this is the most evil thing I've ever seen. And when you have a very face-to-face encounter with what evil looks like, and then you think of Iran, who is trying to face paint the evil and deny its very existence, not only with 6 million Jews, but every one of the females that have to go out veiled, they want them to be like these plastic mannequins. This is evil in itself. This is no way to treat a human being. And my friend Atifi is right. She says, this drives me insane. And it should. It should provoke an anger within you. An offensive anger. But false religion reduces human beings to lifeless forms of plastic. God breathed into our souls love, purpose, and creativity. We are so much different than mannequins. But let me say this to you, to every Iranian woman that has to go out and now has to fear. There are over 7,000 undercover agents, if you will, that are observing, that are watching, that are scrutinizing them, to see if they're compliant with the dress code, to watch their behavior. Iranian women are under fear, even more so now. And when they're treated like these lifeless forms of practice, of plastic, their lives can never shine brightly. If they're reduced to the morbid and depressing existence of mannequins in a store window. When you think of the women in Iran, and I know many of them as my Facebook friends, just in your day-to-day, just take a few moments and lift these beautiful human beings up to God in prayer and just cry out for their freedom, cry out for their salvation, cry out that they will have hope again. Whenever I've talked to Atifi, and she has been so despaired over this, and I know her and her husband both have told me they would love to come to Canada. And I've been praying for them daily to come to Canada, that God will supernaturally open up the doors and that one day Atifi can walk down the streets to go shopping in stores and be treated like a human being, to not have to wear this veil and to be in bondage, to be like a human being, to breathe the air again, to look at nature, to look at the sky, to see the beauty instead of the evil, always before her every day. And so I'm just very thankful that her story is in my book. And I pray that every person that reads this story will come to know the God of the Bible, who treats people with such value and worth, who shows compassion and mercy, and treats them far different than the Iranian regime, who treats human beings like mannequins. Such a sad, sad situation for all of my Iranian friends. It seems like the world that we live in is devaluing human beings and reducing them to these lifeless forms of plastic. How sad our world is. It's not just Iran, but this morning I'm referring to Iran and the way they treat women. And the next time I hear about the war on women, and I hear about it a lot here in political circles, the liberals versus the conservative, it want to makes me scream. And like Atafi, it drives me insane, because the real war on women takes place every day in Iran, takes place every day in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Pakistan. There is a real war on women. So please keep my Facebook friends, my Iranian Facebook friends, in your prayers. I appreciate you so much. Thank you so much. We're going to transition right now. I want you to hear this beautiful, beautiful instrumental song from the movie Shrek. It's a perfect prelude, because we're getting ready now to read from Rahane, A Beautiful Fragrance, on the last half an hour of The Cross in the Desert. Let's listen to this song, and then I'll be back to read Rahane. Beautiful music of Shrek. It's a perfect prelude to the reading of Rahane, A Beautiful Fragrance. We are in chapter 5, and we're going to begin right now. Rahane took a deep breath and tried to relax. She glanced at her watch. It was 6:20 p.m. She sighed in frustration. She realized she was going to be late. Sholeh had asked her to be home by 7 p.m. for dinner. Rahane had promised to be here on time. The meeting with Dr. Sarbani this evening was so important. She had waited several weeks. Surely Mum will understand, Rahane rationalized within herself. After a few minutes, Dr. Sarbani returned with an orange plastic bag and quickly got inside of the car. I'm sorry for the delay. I promise I won't keep you long, Dr. Sarbani reassured her. Rahane smiled and nodded her head. Soon the Toyota had turned into Murdaman Street. The sun was beginning to dip below the horizon. Soon it would be sunset. The oppressive heat had diminished and the evening was beginning to feel much cooler. The black Toyota came to rest in front of the governor's building. A security guard came up to the window. Dr. Sarbani asked him to take care of his automobile. Rahane was astonished. Who is this man? She thought to herself. That a security guard takes orders from him? Chill rushed through her body and was very curious about the man that she had met almost 3 months earlier. Exiting the Toyota, Dr. Sarbani and Rahane entered a 10-story building. Walking through a quiet lobby together, they entered an elevator. Dr. Sarbani pushed the fifth floor button. He wiped the sweat from off of his forehead with a handkerchief and kept staring ahead. He was unusually quiet. Rahane felt her heart begin to beat faster. She was nervous and apprehensive, wondering exactly what to expect next. The elevator arrived at the fifth floor. They walked together straight ahead, arriving at a door in the corridor. The corridor was quiet. There were no pictures on the walls or plants by the windows for decorations. It appeared to be a dirty, deserted building that they had both entered into. Dr. Sarbani removed a key from his pocket and unlocked the door. He stepped inside with his back up against the door and allowed Rahane to walk inside first. Rahane stood inside and gazed around at what appeared to be an empty room. As she walked, she heard a clicking sound made by her shoes that echoed because the room was devoid of any furniture that would normally be inside of an office. She was immediately shocked by what she was observing. The room didn't appear to look like an office at all. It was dirty and musty looking. There was a table near the door with a few chairs around it. Rahane removed her purse and carefully sat down on one of the chairs while Dr. Sarbani put his keys back into his pocket and closed the door. Please make yourself comfortable, Dr. Sarbani said. An eerie and unsettled feeling gripped Rahane's heart. She couldn't relax. She looked carefully at the table in front of her. On the table were another set of keys, a knife stand, two small glasses, and a flower pot. Please relax, Rahane. You may take off your hijab, Dr. Sarbani calmly suggested as he walks past the table and into the kitchen. Rahane could feel beads of sweat roll down her face from inside of her hijab. She was afraid to remove it. Instead, she nervously gazed around the room. In the corner was a television. Next to the television was a dirty old couch covered with a blanket. Rahane also noticed a prayer rug in the center of the room. Dr. Sarbani returned with a glass and quickly gulped down his juice and handed the other glass to Rahane. He then unbuttoned the collar of his white shirt, complaining about the heat. Go ahead and drink, Dr. Sarbani urged her. Rahane sat the glass down on the table in front of her. Her hand began to tremble. Racing thoughts flashed through her mind. She could feel her heart begin to race again. Her mouth became dry from anxiety, but she was afraid to take a drink of the fruit juice. She looked toward the door. Was it locked? She muttered to herself. Rahane inhaled and took a nervous deep breath. Dr. Sarbani isn't a dangerous man, she rationalized to herself. He will sit down in a minute and we will begin our negotiations. While Dr. Sarbani returned to the kitchen to dispose of his glass, Rahane seized the opportunity to get up and inspect the mysterious room on the fifth floor. She walked over to the window, gazing down at the street below. It's much too high up to jump from, she reasoned within herself. Walking toward the center of the living room, she glanced over toward the couch again and noticed that a bed sheet had been spread upon it. Fear gripped Rahane's heart. She suddenly felt trapped with no place to run. Sweat began to roll down her face once again. A feeling of absolute helplessness raced through her mind, putting a death grip on her soul. Dr. Cervantes slowly walked toward her, dangling a small rubber packet in front of her face. "Do you know what this is?" he asked with a sinister smile on his face. Rahane was covered in sweat. Dr. Sorbandi's black eyes penetrated to the very core of her being. He inched closer to her. Suddenly, Rahane bolted up from the chair, energized from a burst of courage. She lunged towards the door and tried to open it. Her hands were slick from sweat. The doorknob seemed impossible to open. "Where are you going?" Dr. Sorbandi sarcastically asked. "You can only leave here when I want you to go." Rahane turned around and fell backwards against the door. Dr. Cervantes inched closer until she could feel his hot breath against her face. He looked bigger as he moved closer. Rahane felt small and helpless. He began to pull at her collar. Rahane immediately retaliated, scratching his face with her long fingernails. Dr. Cervantes moved backwards, covering his face with his hands. Then, without warning, he clasped both of his arms around Rahane's waist, gripping her tightly. "Are you able to escape from here, so you think?" he challenged Rahane while gripping her tightly in his arms. Dr. Cervantes pressed his face up against hers. "I will allow you to go when I want." Dr. Cervantes tightened his grip upon Rahane. "Let me go," Rahane pleaded, struggling to break free of his grip. I will live here and not tell anyone about this. Just let me go." Dr. Cervantes leaned toward Rahane's face and tried to kiss her. At that moment, she managed to finally break free and punched him in the stomach. Quickly recovering from the punch, Dr. Cervantes lifted up Rahane in the air and then dropped her down upon the floor. Rahane struggled to scream but only managed to whimper. Her voice was paralyzed by the shock of what was happening. Dr. Cervantes was now kneeling beside Rahane. He put both of his hands on her waist and began massaging her. Rahane was petrified. "You are stuck now," Dr. Cervantes chuckled with a triumphant tone in his voice. "I am going to take care of you." With one hand, he grabbed Rahane's waist, and with the other, he pulled back her hair. "No one is here. No one can hear you," he chuckled. Terror gripped Rahane's heart. Guilt paralyzed her soul. Why had she been so naive in trusting a strange man? Why had she been so gullible? Sweat rolled down her cheeks. Her eyes were pounding out of her chest. Then she saw the knife. Her eyes fixated upon the shiny small knife that was lying on the table. Dr. Sorbandi followed the gaze of Rahane's eyes and noticed she was staring at the knife. Suddenly, he stopped pulling on her hair and relaxed for a minute, gasping for breath. Then he broke into a sarcastic laugh. "What? Are you going to stab me?" he laughed. And Dr. Sorbandi sat back on his knees, removing his hands from Rahane's body. "Go ahead, do it," Dr. Sorbandi taunted Rahane. Dr. Sorbandi stood up and turned his back away from Rahane. Rahane's whole body was shaking from fear. "Go ahead, do it," Dr. Cervantes shouted once again as he continued to tempt and taunt her. He walked into the living room toward the prayer rug. Realizing this was her only chance to escape, Rahane stood up from the floor and bolted toward the kitchen. She threw open the balcony door and looked down, tempted to jump. She froze in fear. Then she gazed back at the kitchen table, fixing her eyes once again on the knife. Rahane reached down on the table and picked up the knife with her right hand. Her right hand was trembling as she clutched the tiny knife. Dr. Cervantes began to move towards Rahane once again. Then he abruptly turned his back and began taunting her again. "Come on, stab me." Rahane held the knife in her trembling right hand. Tears filled her eyes. "Why are you pretending?" Dr. Cervantes sarcastically asked, spinning around now and facing her. "Go on, do it," he screamed and then laughed as he began walking towards her. "You want to stab me with that?" Dr. Cervantes chuckled, pointing at the tiny knife. "Please, let me go," Rahane nervously pleaded, pointing the knife at him. Dr. Cervantes burst into laughter and then turned around to walk away. All of her life, Rahane had never hurt or harmed anyone. She was compassionate, forgiving, and merciful. But right now, at this moment, it was as if another power had seized control of her mind and emotions. She felt as if she were dangling from the edge of a cliff. She felt suffocated and trapped, like she had been stuffed inside of a trunk, and now she was desperately trying to claw her way out. In desperation and fear, she lifted up the knife as Dr. Sorbandi began to walk away and plunged it deep inside of his back, near his right shoulder. Immediately, Dr. Sorbandi screamed in pain. Rahane clasped both of her hands across her mouth in fear. She couldn't believe what she had just done. Dr. Sorbandi staggered and moaned as blood began gushing out from his back. He collapsed down on the floor, breathing heavily and writhing in pain. Then he reached down with his right hand and pulled the knife from out of his back. Rahane had stabbed him in the back just a few inches below his left shoulder. There were splattered blood stains on both the mirror and the fan. Picking up the knife in anger, Dr. Sorbandi threw it toward Rahane. Then he stood back up, staggering to his feet. Rahane located the knife on the floor and once again clutched it in her right hand. Dr. Sorbandi grabbed tightly onto the chair to maintain his balance. His hands were drenched in blood. He was extremely weak and in shock. Suddenly, with all of his remaining strength, he picked up the chair and hurled it towards Rahane in an outburst of rage and anger. The chair missed Rahane and landed in the corner, breaking it into pieces. Panic-stricken, Rahane bolted toward the front door and began pounding her fists against it, screaming for help. In the midst of her screaming, the door abruptly swung open. To Rahane's utter amazement, Mr. Shecky stood on the other side of the door, his eyes bulging in astonishment. "What's going on here?" Mr. Shecky demanded, his voice cracking in fear. Rahane didn't answer, but instead pushed Mr. Shecky out of the way and ran quickly out of the open door. She raced past the elevators and instead began running down the flights of stairs. Gasping for breath, Rahane finally arrived on the first floor, and without hesitation, she bolted out of the front entrance into the street. Grabbing her cell phone out of her pocket, she promptly called the paramedics and explained what had happened. Rahane had begun the day feeling very positive and optimistic. The number 7 had seemed to be a magical blessing that was going to bring her happiness and prosperity. However, the number 7 had not been a blessing, but had instead turned out to be a curse, an unbelievable nightmare that had forced her to make a choice that would forever alter the course of her life. Chapter 6, The Arrest. Rahane was late. Her mother had just called her cell phone. Sholay was worried. Rahane apologized and assured her that she was on her way home. The taxi cab seemed to take forever. She gazed out the window at the beautiful sunset. It was now 8:15 p.m. She closed her eyes and took a deep breath. Images of blood, Sorbandi pulling the knife from out of his back, tormented her mind. Rahane tried to relax. It was to no avail. The nightmare, the racing thoughts, and the unforgettable scenes of violence were suffocating her. Rahane held on tightly to her purse. Inside was the knife, still bloodstained from her desperate ordeal to stay alive. Her right hand began to tremble. She felt numb all over. Was Dr. Sorbandi going to be all right? Did the paramedics get there in time? Why did this happen? Rahane quietly pondered to herself. Just this morning, she was so happy, so optimistic, and now she was terrified. The taxi arrived at Sharati Street at the corner of Dot Alley. She was finally home. Rahane promptly paid the driver 10,000 tomans and hurried out the door. It was getting dark now. Night had fallen in the city of Tehran, and Rahane was so anxious to crawl into bed and disappear under the covers, hoping the day would quickly come to an end, and maybe she would finally awaken to find out it had all been a terrible, terrible dream. Sholay looked up from the kitchen sink where she had been busy washing fruit. Rouhani could see the anger in her eyes. She realized right away that her mother was not in a good mood. Rouhani quickly removed her headscarf in order to conceal the bloodstains. It was an accident, Rouhani replied, nervously stuttering. Sholi turned off the faucet and faced her daughter. She had a stunned expression on her face. Accident? What do you mean? You didn't drive today. Sholi's astute observation took Rouhani by surprise. She was forced to quickly come up with a satisfactory answer in order to conceal the truth of what really happened. I had an accident in my friend's car. Sholi took an angry deep breath and gave Rouhani a look of displeasure. I have repeatedly told you not to drive other people's cars. It's bad luck for us. Rouhani reached up and took a glass from out of the cabinet and filled it with cold water. She took a big gulp and relaxed against the counter of the kitchen sink. I'm going up to my room, Mom. It's been a horrible day. Rouhani felt trapped. She wanted to hug her mother and tell her the truth. The voices inside of her head were screaming to be let out, but she couldn't. She was much too afraid. Closing the door behind her, Rouhani quickly changed her clothes. After she finished, she removed the knife from her purse and hid it underneath the bed. She briefly looked in the mirror and stood completely still, frozen and numb by the reflection that was staring back at her. Had she really become the person that she was now gazing at in the mirror? Was she a victim tonight, defending herself against a monstrous rapist, or had she become a real cold-blooded killer? Tears began to fill her eyes. All she could see in her mind's eye was Dr. Serbandi sitting on the floor, covered in blood, and pulling the knife out of his back. Rouhani threw herself on top of the bed and covered her face in shame. Suddenly, there was a knock at the door. Rouhani didn't move, but remained lying face down in her bed in tears. After a few moments, Sholi walked into the room. Are you all right? Sholi put a glass of tea and an apple on her dresser and sat down on the edge of the bed next to Rouhani. All right, Rouhani, get up now. Don't be a baby. Rouhani rolled over and sat up on her bed. She couldn't look her mother in her eyes. She was afraid. Sholi had an amazing gift for reading Rouhani's eyes and knowing exactly what had happened. Sholi took both of Rouhani's hands and began to massage them. Immediately, a feeling of peace flooded Rouhani's soul, chasing away all of her anxieties. Sholi looked intently into Rouhani's eyes as she continued massaging. How bad was the accident? Terrible! Rouhani bitterly replied. Her hands began to tense up again. Sholi continued massaging. Did you hit someone? No. Sholi breathed a sigh of relief. Thank God. Then it's not important. But I think I caused a lot of damage, Rouhani said, interrupting. That doesn't matter. Just be thankful that you didn't hit someone. Rouhani drew closer to her mother and laid her head against her chest. Sholi began to gently stroke her hair. Rouhani began to calm down and relax. When I see you in turmoil, Sholi whispered gently into Rouhani's ears, it's as if someone stabbed me in the heart. I hate to see you upset. Rouhani looked up and warmly smiled at her mother and then laid her head back down against her chest. So, how did the meeting with Serbandi go? Sholi's question caught Rouhani by surprise. She took a deep breath and tensed up again. Did you make a deal with them? Sholi anxiously asked. No, I decided not to go, Rouhani nervously answered. Oh, I'm so glad. I never had a good feeling about that man. Rouhani's whole body tensed up with fear and anxiety again. She desperately wanted to tell her mother the truth, but was terrified at what her reaction would be. Instead, Rouhani retreated into her world of guilt and shame. Oh, Mom, can I sleep now? Rouhani asked. Go to sleep, Sholi replied. I will call you when dinner is ready. Sholi planted a warm kiss on Rahane's forehead. A tiny tear trickled down her face. She remembered a game she used to play with her mother as a child. Rouhani would kiss each of her fingers. Her mother would respond by touching her face with her hand and then gently putting it up to her lips. Rouhani longed for her childhood days when she was full of playful innocence and she didn't have to worry about growing up for a very long time. As soon as the door was shut, Rouhani bowed her face in her hands and began to sob. She desperately wanted to awaken from this nightmare and discover that everything that had happened today had been nothing but a very bad dream. Dinner is ready. Rouhani couldn't move. She felt paralyzed on the bed. Dinner is ready. Are you coming? Shirley once again shouted from outside of Rouhani's bedroom door. Rouhani's arms and legs were numb with fear. How much longer could she keep the truth from her mother? Down inside, she longed for the days when her mother would bring food to her in bed. But today, that wasn't happening. Rouhani turned over on her side and began weeping. The trauma of what had happened just a few hours ago was tormenting her soul. Wiping the tears from her eyes, Rouhani quickly tried to compose herself. She could hear her mother walking toward the bedroom door. Quickly, she rolled over on her left side, pretending to be asleep. She could hear Sholi quietly tiptoe inside of the room. Next, she felt a warm kiss on her cheek. "Sweet dreams, daughter," Sholi whispered in her ear. Then she heard the door close again. The annoying sound of a cell phone ringing abruptly awakened Rouhani out of deep sleep. She reached over on her dresser and quickly picked up her mobile. "Salam," Farsi for hello, Rouhani answered, rubbing her tired eyes. The strange-sounding voice of a man quickly replied, "There has been an incident and your number was found on a cell phone." A rush of fear gripped Rahane's heart. She was now fully awake and alert, sitting up on the bed, clutching her cell phone tightly against her ear. "Do you know Dr. Sarbandi?" the voice on the other end of the phone inquired. "Yes," Rahane nervously answered. "What time did you meet him tonight?" "About 6 p.m. "Do you know that he's been injured?" "Yes. How's he doing?" "Fine, but you must come to the police station number 104 in Abbas Abad." Rouhani's hands suddenly became slippery with sweat. She stood up and began to pace. "Why do I need to come?" "Just to answer some questions." "I can't come now," Rouhani replied, "but I will be there first thing in the morning." "It can't wait until tomorrow," the man insisted. "You must come right now." Unsure of what to say, Rouhani abruptly hung up and stood facing her mirror, trembling with fear. Dark circles were forming around her eyes from very little sleep. Her face was pale with fear. She was starving. The last time she had eaten was hours ago, but food was the last thing on her mind right now. A few minutes passed, and once again her cell phone rang. Rouhani stood down at her cell phone lying in the middle of the bed. She didn't want to answer. She gazed at the clock. It was 11:15 p.m. The loud ringing might wake up her family. Rouhani quickly grabbed her cell phone and answered. It was the same voice once again on the other end. "We are standing in front of your apartment," the voice proclaimed. "Come and open the door or we will come in. We are armed." "Who are you?" Rouhani shouted back in desperation. "Police," the voice abruptly answered. "Wait, I will be down right away," Rouhani promised. As quietly as possible, Rouhani ran out of her bedroom door, down the corridor, and around the corner. With trembling hands, she opened the front door. There were three uniformed men standing on the porch. Chief Shamlou, dressed in a white shirt and wearing white striped pants, pushed open the door. His face was covered in a clean-shaven black beard. He gave Rouhani a defiant stare with his penetrating blue eyes. Next to Shamlou was a short, stocky man dressed in a gray pinstripe suit with a gun in his belt holster. He introduced himself as Officer Kamali from No. 10 Shapur Investigation Office. The third man was a tall, slender individual, which Rouhani later found out was named Murabadi, who served as the official driver of the officer's vehicle. That is going to conclude our reading today of Rouhani, A Beautiful Fragrance. Join me next Monday as we continue. God bless you and have a great week. I will see you then.
Like a flower.